This is the takeaway for Wednesday, February 15th, 2017.
This is the takeaway, special Tetris edition of the takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And remember, when the whole issue of Donald Trump and Russia was some hacked emails, just some puzzling statement about what a great guy Vladimir Putin seemed to be, and anticipation that U.S.-Russia policy was going to change somehow when the administration took office, well, that has all changed. With the resignation of former General Mike Flynn for allegedly misleading officials about his discussions with Russian officials, it's now a chorus of leaks depicting a presidential campaign in touch with senior Russian intelligence officials weeks before the presidential election. You may recall that in 1980, the Reagan administration was accused of being in touch with Iranian officials to get the American hostages released and defeat Jimmy Carter. Iran received a pro quo favor from that deal in the form of U.S. weapons, and people served time and were convicted of crimes because of that. But accusations of contact with Iran during the campaign, the Reagan campaign, the quid, was never proven. And indeed, no one is standing up to these allegations besides General Flynn, who was outed before he resigned. The New York Times says besides General Flynn, the FBI has questioned businessman Carter Page and longtime Republican activist and outspoken hired gun of the GOP, Roger Stone, who told this program on Inauguration Day he is completely out of the picture.
First of all, I had no contacts with Russia. I've never been to Russia. I never spoke to any Russians within this election cycle or any election cycle. I don't know any Russians. I was never in contact with them. I've never raised money from them. I've never gotten money from them. I was not a conduit between the Trump campaign and any Russian influence.
Well, that settles that, obviously. The FBI apparently also talked to Paul Manafort, an activist with the Trump campaign and with the GOP. With the latest is Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. My, what a feast you have before you, Mr. Zwillick.
It is, and the feast keeps getting longer. That table keeps getting longer and longer, especially for members of the Senate on Capitol Hill, John. The New York Times piece that came out last night, which is really largely as you described, these ongoing contacts, according to U.S. intelligence officials, unnamed, by the way, to the Times, that they have been investigating ongoing contacts between members of the Trump campaign. You know, this is all of a piece with General Flynn's resignation, and it doesn't change a lot of facts on the ground in the Senate and House intelligence committees where the investigations are supposed to be going on. But it definitely intensifies them and intensifies the motives for many senators to get this investigated. And I'm not just talking about the Democrats. First, let me tell you, on the House side, John, very little appetite for investigating really any of this. There is an investigation in the House intelligence committee, but that chairman, Devin Nunes of California, has basically said that he thinks General Flynn is a patriotic American. He doesn't see a great deal of need to dig down too far into this. Jason Chaffetz, who runs the Oversight Committee, has said that Flynn's resignation has taken care of the problem and that he's not going to investigate it. But senators, they have a longer timeline, and senators need 60 votes to do things. And senators, Republicans and Democrats, feel very differently about getting investigations more intense. As I said, they are in the Intelligence Committee, now part of the question. Does that get broader to an independent committee or a bipartisan committee? Or a commission, or does it go to the DOJ? Here's Claire McCaskill. She's a Democrat from Missouri.
Frankly, this administration ought to want a public airing of this if they want to be able to govern, because the questions are so numerous that it's very hard to get past them and begin to look at some of the things like infrastructure or tax reform or even confirming a Supreme Court nominee.
We should say, Todd, and put this in context, please, if you can, all this really boils down to is, does Flynn know something, and can he testify in front of a hearing and change the game here?
That's one of the big questions, and one of the interesting things that you saw right away yesterday was not just Democrats, but Republicans coming out and saying that, yes, likely Flynn is going to have to come and testify, whether or not that's in the confines of the Intelligence Committee, where hearings can be closed if they're deemed classified, shielded from the media and the prying eyes of the public, or whether it's in open hearings. Here's Roy Blunt. He's on the Intelligence Committee, also from Missouri. He's Claire McCaskill's Republican Missouri partner and a member of the Republican leadership.
The Intel Committee, the Intelligence Committee, is looking at what the Obama administration left on the table about Russia and our elections. But I think it's likely that General Flynn will be at some point asked to come and talk to the committee about both post-election activities and any other activities that he would be aware of.
Now, you know, I don't want to sound like a cynic, but is that a little disingenuous? We're looking at the Obama administration, and by the way, we might take a look at Flynn.
Yeah, what you hear from Senator Blunt there is kind of a, gives you the spirit of where Republicans are at on this right now. You have lots of Republicans who really feel like Claire McCaskill. In fact, let me play you Bob Corker here because this is short. Republicans who basically think, and I talked to many of them yesterday on and off mic, basically saying we need to get this aired out because if we don't, we're not going to be able to do all of the other parts of our agenda. Listen to Corker.
You know, for this whole thing to be purged, okay, and for people to understand what has happened and to put it behind us, I just think it's an important thing for us to do.
Am I wrong, Todd, or is Corker the dude here? I mean, he's the point man. He's the kind of canary in the coal mine here on all this.
Bob Corker has been running point for Donald Trump since the campaign and now finds himself in a position as chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee trying to manage a souring relationship between many Republicans, especially national security hawks, and the White House as these Russia connections continue to roil. So here's Bob Corker, yes, saying, hey, I'm one of the people who agrees with Claire McCaskill in a way to say we need to get this aired out because if the public and senators remain obsessed with the Russia connections and we don't find out the depths of this and get it cleared off the decks, we're not going to be able to do some of the big things that we want to do. And, you know, some people agree in an opposite way with the Corker faction, and there are many Republican senators who feel that way. Listen to Rand Paul here. Rand Paul was on Fox News Radio basically agreeing with Corker that it could be a problem, but he says bury it.
I just don't think it's useful to be doing investigation after investigation, particularly of your own party. We'll never even get started with doing the things we need to do, like repealing Obamacare, if we're spending our whole time having Republicans investigate Republicans. I think it makes no sense.
Can you do that? I mean, can you hold something like this up, especially when you've got people like, and I can't resist this, Senator Chuck Schumer, Democrat of New York, in the Senate, doing a real primal scream on all of this, because this is really right up his alley.
I think that Rand Paul is more of an isolated voice in the Republican conference in the Senate, and I talked to many of them yesterday. More and more of them are feeling that this news and also the substance of possible Russia ties from the Trump campaign and General Flynn and possibly others needs to be aired out. Now, how much that's aired out? Look, John, the truth is they want to keep this confined to the Intelligence Committee. I'm not suggesting to you that Senate Republicans are like, yep, independent investigation, let it ride. You know, they're not saying that. And they do have some control over that Intelligence Committee. They can go into closed session. They can deem things classified.
Right.
It's not a free-for-all. However, it's not like the House, where House members and Rand Paul are in a hunker-down mode. You mentioned Chuck Schumer. You'd expect the Democrats to be more partisan and much more out in front of this, and that's what you got. Here's the Democratic leader yesterday saying that the DOJ itself needs to have an independent investigation, and he even talked about the new attorney general.
I believe that General Sessions has no choice but to recuse himself, and then he should and must put an independent investigative authority in charge. There are potential criminal violations here.
So he wants an independent counsel. I mean, he wants to revisit the whole Oliver North situation. Is it possible that General Flynn is an Oliver North kind of character, going back to the Iran-Contra hearings, where Flynn knows something about policy that puts the whole administration in jeopardy?
Well, here's let's be clear about what Chuck Schumer is saying and what he's not saying. He's avoiding the independent counsel dirty word. He's not saying that, but he's not saying it. He's saying, look, potential criminal violations, the Logan Act. Private citizens aren't allowed to do diplomacy.
Right.
That's illegal. The Emoluments Clause, we've talked about that on the show, and other
right.
potential criminal violations. What is General Flynn in all this? I don't know, and many senators say they don't know, but the questions that they're hanging out there, when you look at the White House timeline of when the Department of Justice informed the White House and thus informed the president a little over 3 weeks ago that Mike Flynn might be compromised or is compromised because of what the Russians know about him talking to them and then being untruthful with other White House personnel, is when was the president informed?
Right.
If the president knew this, did they continue to give General Flynn access to highly classified information once the Justice Department said, hey, he might be compromised? These are some of the questions now that are starting to swirl
around this.
And I'll just leave it here with you, John. Republicans in the Senate are on board. They realize this is becoming a deep political liability for them. They're on board with an investigation. The only question now is how deep and what committees and how high profile does that investigation
go? We played on this program yesterday that audio from Donald Trump saying he hadn't heard the reports, and so he was kind of out of the loop. That's going to be part of the investigation. But I can't resist. Normally, I'm, you know, unimpressed by the hand-wringing of Lindsey Graham all the time. But in this particular case, the senator is doing one of these I told you so's that is like written up in lights in Times Square. Could we hear Lindsey Graham?
What I'd like to know is, did General Flynn make this phone call by himself? If he was directed, by who? Because the one president at a time policy, I think, has served the country well. And I can only imagine what Republicans would say if the Obama administration had reached out to Iran or Iraq or any other government to say, just be patient, we're going to change some policies of the Bush administration. We would all be pretty upset about that.
So where do we stand? What does this mean, and what could happen next?
We talked all about the investigations, John, all through the top of the show here. Lindsey Graham is one of those national security and Russia hawks. He wants to go one step further. Not only does he want a full airing of this, Lindsey Graham is going to be one of the guys that you see out there pushing for even stronger Russian sanctions at a time when the White House has sent many signals that they would like to pull back on some of those Russian sanctions. No. Lindsey Graham is the guy who says we want stronger Russian sanctions. By the way, Donald Trump is having dinner at the White House with Marco Rubio this evening. That's on the schedule. Marco Rubio, another Russia hawk who has gone on the Senate floor and says that he wants a crackdown on Russia. So there's a charm offensive going on at the same time. I don't know if the senator and the president will discuss Russia, but I can tell you Marco Rubio is in the Lindsey Graham camp here, and he wants a crackdown.
Fantastic stuff. Todd Zwillig, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Thanks so much, Todd.
You bet, John.
From U.S.-Russia relations to U.S.-Israel policy, President Trump met with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu today. From last week's apparent U.S. capitulation on supporting aggressive Israeli settlement building on occupied Palestinian land and moving the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, now the Trump administration has walked back all those policy details. An advisor to Prime Minister Netanyahu predicted that there wasn't going to be any daylight between the two leaders today at a news conference at the White House, but some observers might have been a little blinded by Trump's attempt to straddle the fence today.
So I'm looking at two state and one state, and I like the one that both parties like. I'm very happy with the one that both parties like. I can live with either one. I thought for a while the two state looked like it may be the easier of the two. But honestly, if Bibi and if the Palestinians, if Israel and the Palestinians are happy, I'm happy with the one they like the best.
Donald Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, was at this news conference and was a big presence in the pre-election talks with Israeli officials. He has since been appointed the leading advisor on Middle East affairs and witnessed President Trump attempting to put some pressure on Prime Minister Netanyahu regarding the settlements issue.
As far as settlements, I'd like to see you hold back on settlements for a little bit. We'll work something out, but I would like to see a deal be made. I think a deal will be made.
Ambassador Dennis Ross is a former Middle East peace negotiator under Presidents George H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton. He's the author of Doomed to Succeed, the U.S.-Israel Relationship from Truman to Obama. He says after all the confusion on the Trump administration's position, a deal may be more elusive than the president predicted today.
There were a lot of assumptions made about what the Trump administration approach towards settlements would be because he had selected David Friedman as his ambassador to Israel. Friedman has been was out there very publicly, in effect, opposing a two-state outcome on the one hand and being very clearly a friend of the settler movement. And yet, suddenly, you have a statement from the White House that literally could have been made by the Bill Clinton administration, because the statement said that the existence of settlements is not an obstacle to peace, but new settlements or expanding existing ones may not help advance peace. And ironically, when Bill Clinton became president, he felt that George H.W. Bush had focused too much on settlements, and Bush's line had been they're an obstacle to peace, and Bill Clinton changed that and said, well, they're not helpful. So you have that, plus you have Trump giving an interview to the Israel newspaper called Israel Hayom, the paper owned by Sheldon Adelson, in which he says, you know, there's not a lot of territory. If you take new territory for settlements, you have less available, and that I'm not someone who believes that that advances peace. So it suggests that there will be a limitation on settlement activity, even if the Trump administration at this point doesn't explicitly say we're for two states. There does appear to be two things going on in the Trump administration. One is that when it comes to settlements, they think there needs to be some kind of limitation. And two, they may actually have a higher interest in pursuing the Israeli-Palestinian peace issue than most people thought.
Some of my more conspiratorial sources in the Middle East suggested that, in fact, below the radar and some sort of Saudi stop sign put the kibosh on this settlement policy, in that they believe that you've got to do something on settlements to keep a new intifada from breaking out. And so, boom, all of this has changed. Does that sound plausible to you?
I think it's less the Saudis, and I think it was King Abdullah of Jordan who did come to Washington, had a brief meeting with President Trump, but saw Vice President Pence, saw the new Secretary of State Tillerson. And I think one of the issues I think that he raised was, look, we're your partners in fighting ISIS because we're on the front lines. Don't take steps that put us on the defensive. Hmm. And so I think that's what contributed to the posture on settlements. And probably also there was a lot of expectation there was going to be a very rapid move of the Jerusalem embassy, or meaning the embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. And I'm not saying that the Trump administration may still not do something on moving the embassy, but it's clear they're not rushing to that at this point. And again, Trump himself, when he's been asked the question about this, said this is, first he said too early to talk about it, then he said it's a very difficult decision, a lot there, and I'm looking at it seriously. So again, that suggests that there was a more deliberative process on that issue than necessarily we've seen on some of the other issues.
What do you think of the fact that Jared Kushner, Trump's son-in-law, appears to have your old job?
Right. You know, what's interesting, in the Middle East, what matters more than anything else, if you're going to be an envoy, is that you're seen as being authoritative. You know, when I used to walk into a room during the Clinton administration, nobody questioned whether I spoke for the president. And that means you get a hearing, you're taken seriously, and the like. Well, I think everyone, if in fact Jared Kushner is going to play that role, no one's going to question whether he's authoritative. And that's probably the attribute you have to have if you're going to be a negotiator. You know, by itself, obviously, it doesn't deliver anything because you still actually have to deal with parties whose gaps right now are very difficult to close. But it's an essential attribute. And I think actually if he has the time, because it seems that he has wide responsibilities, if he can have the kind of support structure, I think actually he could probably play the role. And it will reflect more than anything else, ultimately, what is the priority of the administration? If this issue really matters to the administration, that's probably going to count for more than almost anything else.
Ambassador Dennis Ross is a former Middle East peace negotiator under Presidents George H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton and the author of Doomed to Succeed, the U.S.-Israel Relationship from Truman to Obama. He spoke to us from Santa Fe, New Mexico. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
In this environment, can the NFL be a goodwill ambassador in Israel? Maybe not. A trip to Israel by some NFL players has been cast as a propaganda exercise, and some players have balked. Dave Zirin, sports editor for The Nation magazine and host of the Edge of Sports podcast, has written an open letter to the players arguing they shouldn't take the Israeli offer. He received support from prominent figures like Harry Belafonte, Danny Glover, and 1968 Olympian John Carlos. This action influenced four players to actually cancel their visit altogether.
They were going to visit some of the quote-unquote safer settlements. They were going to visit communities of black Israelis who'd emigrated from Ethiopia, who were very happy to be there, like particular communities that were not part of the huge demonstrations that took place last year of black Israelis, black immigrants, refugees living in Israel. What it comes down to is that this member of the Israeli government really did make a mistake by going to the Times of Israel and really bragging about the fact that the players would be going on this tightly circumscribed trip.
Does this remind you of the controversy that entertainers confronted when they were invited to play at Sun City, which was a venue in South Africa during the times of, pre-Mandela, and the Springbok controversy where the rugby team, the Springboks, were banned from playing around the world in certain places precisely because of the politics in South Africa?
Absolutely. You know, one of the organizers of the South African sports movement against apartheid, an organization called SANROC, was a man named Dennis Brutus. He passed away in 2010. Before his death, he was at the University of Pittsburgh teaching, and he was attempting to organize athletes in the United States and Europe to have a similar posture towards Israel, to say that sports really is politics, sports is a kind of diplomacy, and that people should take very seriously the idea of not doing these kinds of goodwill sporting events if these events were meant to prop up one side of the conflict.
Well, there's no individual in the equivalent of Robben Island in Israel that could, emerge and suddenly change the situation. I mean, we may be looking here at a situation where from now on, all professional athletes in the United States will be faced with precisely this kind of controversy unless something very seriously changes in the state of Israel.
No, I think that's absolutely right. And this is especially true as the world gets smaller and smaller and as movements like Black Lives Matter in the United States start making more and more connections with people in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. I mean, that was a big part of the story of Black Lives Matter, about people talking over Skype, about how to resist tear gas, murals on the walls in Gaza dedicated to Michael Brown. These connections aren't small things. It's an international awakening that I think could have huge repercussions, especially because so many pro athletes come from neighborhoods, like Ferguson, like New Orleans, like places that have experienced racism. And if they're growing up in a politicized context that looks at these issues globally, you will see these kinds of issues flower in the years to come.
Or another explanation is that you, Dave Zirin, have basically taken a cue from an international conspiracy against Israel that is anti-Semitic and wants to see the destruction of the state. And that's what this is all about.
Yeah, well, my rabbi might disagree with that. I'm proudly Jewish, but I've always said this, is that I was raised in the temple, and I've always was raised to believe that being Jewish and being an uncritical supporter of Israel are two very, very different things.
Dave Zirin, sports editor for The Nation magazine and host of the Edge of Sports podcast, spoke to us from Washington, D.C. Dave, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Legal scholars may argue that when the Supreme Court ruled 5-3 in the Texas Whole Women's Health versus Hellerstadt case in 2016, that the court was signaling that case law on abortion was settling down and that issues available for banning abortion may be dwindling. Well, Since the 2010 midterm elections, when the Congress began its shift to the GOP, states, also largely GOP-controlled, have channeled their energies into writing new restrictive laws. Under the leadership of then-Governor Mike Pence, Indiana was among them. Add to that the list of Kansas, Texas, Oklahoma, Arkansas, Arizona, North Carolina, North Dakota, Ohio, Louisiana, Pennsylvania, and Mississippi. And listen to Republican Governor of Kentucky Matt Bevin speaking in January of this year after signing two bills, one of which compels a woman to listen to a fetal heartbeat and observe an ultrasound of her live fetus before an abortion can proceed.
And I personally believe that it's inappropriate to kill human beings that are innocent. I just do. And it's hard for me to imagine a scenario under which somebody could tell me that killing innocent human beings is a good thing.
In 2016, according to the Center for Reproductive Rights, there have been 500 proposed and 60 restrictions enacted, laws that have been challenged in some states, but in others, the restrictions stand. Elizabeth Nash is senior state issues manager at the Guttmacher Institute, a research and policy organization that focuses on sexual and reproductive health. Elizabeth alerted us first to the Arkansas law.
So when we're talking about the Arkansas law, we're talking about a law that doesn't use any medical language, but essentially bans the most common method used after 12 weeks for a woman to terminate her pregnancy. And, you know, we've started to see these laws pop up since 2015, and they are in effect in two states, West Virginia and Mississippi, and they've been challenged in four states where they're not in effect. So we are seeing court cases challenging these laws because the idea here is that they're banning a method of abortion. So they're really interfering with doctor practice, physician practice, and they are really, you know, making it very difficult to access abortions after, you know, 12 weeks or so. So in that case, you know, you really are in a conflict with the Supreme Court standards that says that you can't ban abortion before viability, and you really have to have exceptions that protect the woman's life and health.
And if we're talking about, you know, periods of time as short as 12 weeks, this could have huge effects on women's lives before any challenge comes to the Supreme Court or the federal courts at all.
Yes, they really can. And evidence matters. You know, there has to be proof that these kinds of restrictions have some sort of benefit. And really, for most abortion restrictions, there is no benefit. You know, they don't improve women's lives at all. They don't improve the safety of abortion. They don't improve access to abortion. They don't help women have abortions when they need them. So, you know, these restrictions really fail that test. And I think we're going to see that more in the cases that are pending.
Let's look at Oklahoma. That Oklahoma bill is a bill that goes in a completely different direction. It allows a patient's partner to enter a sort of veto by making the consent of the partner essential to the carrying out of the abortion. How unique is this tactic? How challengeable is it? And how likely is it to affect people before a challenge occurs?
You know, this is a very old idea. We started to see these in the early 70s, right after Roe was handed down. And in the mid-70s, the U.S. Supreme Court struck down a spousal consent requirement. So this is done. This is something that has been up to the Supreme Court and done. So the fact that they're trying to bring this back is a bit mind-blowing. Typically in Oklahoma, when a law is enacted, it doesn't go into effect till November 1st. And so what would probably happen was if this were to be signed, and that isn't a completely done deal, you know, there would be some time to pull together a legal challenge. And typically Oklahoma abortion restrictions are challenged, and many of them have been struck down by the Oklahoma Supreme Court.
Let's look at the state of Kentucky. The governor, Matt Bevin, has signed two bills. So, you know, these are active laws here. What do they do as far as provide a, you know, tactic for getting around Roe v. Wade? And how likely, again, are they to affect people before there's a challenge?
So in Kentucky, you know, Kentucky's an interesting situation. you know, as of last year, the House was still controlled by the Democrats, and so it was very difficult for conservatives to pass abortion restrictions. And now, this year after the election, all three chambers are controlled by conservatives. So abortion really got to the front burner on the agenda. So we saw two laws enacted so far on abortion. One requires an ultrasound before a woman obtains an abortion, as well as she has to listen to the fetal heartbeat. And the second law bans abortion at about 20 weeks post-fertilization. What we see, you know, in these laws, so not only do they have to listen to the heartbeat, the monitor has to be moved so they can see it. And they're allowed to close their eyes, but you still have to listen to a description and the heartbeat.
Let's conclude on a proposed bill in Iowa that takes this into the civil realm. And there's also a couple of other bills that I understand that would allow family members or other people like grandparents to sue post-abortion for their own pain and suffering, which would create a disincentive for clinics to offer abortion under any circumstances. Now, this civil business seems like a whole new, you know, can of worms here legally.
You know, we have been seeing more and more of these civil lawsuit bills show up. And really, this is, you know, these can have a real chilling effect on provider practice because they allow generally the woman, her partner, or certain family members to sue after an abortion. And what makes the Iowa bill so interesting, and now we're seeing one similar in Florida, is that it allows to sue for emotional distress around the counseling requirements. And yes, this is all about trying to keep providers from performing abortions. It's not about health and safety.
Elizabeth Nash is Senior State Issues Manager at the Guttmacher Institute. She spoke with us from Washington, D.C. Thanks so much, Elizabeth.
Thank you for having me.
When someone goes to prison, the hearts and lives of spouses, children, mothers, and friends go along with them. The separation inside a prison cell is mirrored outside by an empty bed, a car no longer driven, a father no longer available to take a child to the movies, a playground, a ball game. If we can estimate that one inmate leaves conservatively perhaps 3 to 4 loved ones alone on the outside, the community of African Americans left full of human holes made by people serving time is 6 times the size of white Americans. That's the disparity represented by the overrepresentation of African Americans in the U.S. prison system. Alon is one of those women left behind. She lives in New Orleans. Her boyfriend Desmond has been in a Louisiana prison for more than a year awaiting trial. Alon is now a single mother. Filmmaker Garrett Bradley tells the story of Alon's struggle and the stigma associated with loving someone behind bars in her film called Alone.
In a lot of ways, being with somebody who's incarcerated isn't always so different, I might say, from being with somebody who is gone all the time. The result in your body, in your heart, is the same. It's loneliness.
Desmond asked me to marry him, and he's still incarcerated. It's been a year. Still no sentence, no verdict.
Alon is super well educated. She's got a really bright soul. And a lot of the questions that she asks herself throughout the film and outside of the film are questions that aren't always so different from the ones that any woman might ask themselves who's alone. Like, should I stay with this person? Am I happy? How do I create happiness in a world where I'm dictating my day on my own without the support or physical intimacy of another person? It's all about, how do you create a full life for yourself?
How do I see myself? Attractive, beautiful, glamorous, having a happy glow off of me, with a cathedral train, lots of lace, detail, pearls, diamonds everywhere. I want to be able to say, I feel happy. I'm beautiful in this dress. I'm sexy in this dress.
And what does love mean? I mean, is love really about passion and being there for someone? Or are these very practical things just as important, you know? Maybe being in love with someone isn't enough to be with them. Maybe you need to be with someone who's physically there all the time. I mean, I think that's a question everybody asks. What is love? What's its purpose in my life? And it's different for everybody.
I hate you. I hate those lies I told you. I want to marry you and only you. I want to look back 20 years into our long life marriage and say, look where we come from. Look at what got us here. I love you so much, babe. So much. Will you honestly marry me? Baby, I want this with you forever. Forever lifetime with you. Only you.
These private companies like Securus and Telecoin allow families to communicate with those that are behind bars, and they make quite a bit of money. I think Alon spends a minimum $400 a month just to talk to Desmond, because physical visits are not allowed. Even if you physically went to the prison, you wouldn't even be able to be on the other side of glass. You know, you'd still have to go through some kind of video. And I don't know. It's funny because I think about these sort of like prison Skype chats, right? These one-on-one interactions that are through online systems, and this idea of feeling close and yet being very, very removed at the same time. I think that there is something to be said for that connection and what it means to live in a world where you are on one hand connected to millions of people and yet at the same time not at all.
What would it look like to marry Desmond in prison? Feeling that you're alone, knowing that you're alone. It's a scary point.
It was really, really difficult for her. I did help facilitate interviews with other women who had already embarked on this process. So Fox Rich, for instance, is a woman who's here in New Orleans. Her husband's been in Angola State Prison for 20 years now. And Fox has been a single mother since then.
This system breaks you apart. It is designed just like slavery to tear you apart. And instead of using the whip, they use mother time. They use hardships. They may not hang you from the tree, but the experience itself is just like when they used to hang people, but barely hang them and leave their feet just tiptoeing around in the mud so that they're constantly on their tiptoes fighting for their life. That is a daily experience when you are an incarcerated family.
The separation of families is strategic, and it's something that our country has done to Black people for, you know, over 400 years. And there are results that come from that systematic separation in terms of the development of children and their connection to their parents. And I think more than anything, you know, when Lon was thinking about marriage and being with somebody who is behind bars, it occurred to me at that point that it wasn't necessarily about playing a wife or being a wife in the typical sense, right? Marriage almost became a symbol for counteracting this history.
I keep thinking to myself, what would it mean to marry someone behind bars? What would it look like? 10 years of waving between walls, gates, courtrooms, and lawyers. I go to bed at night holding myself, not feeling that body, not getting that human contact. I have dreams that they are letting him out, and then I wake up smiling, but still sad, still alone, still in limbo. And maybe that's how it's going to be for now, held by time, connected by love.
You can possibly question the judgments made by people who end up in jail, but you can't argue with the deep feelings of these families and friends and loved ones. Garrett Bradley is the filmmaker and director of Alone. You can watch Garrett's film now. Find a link at thetakeaway.org.
I mean, I just am so honored to be on the end of her lead. Her type for our breed and her details are so exquisite. And yet she's so level-headed, and she loves to do this.
Oh, she just has a super attitude, you know. I mean, she loves the show, and she's, you know, has a real vivaciousness for life, so to speak.
I'm a dog person, and I raise dogs, and I go to dog shows, and, you know, you try to show your stock and do a good job with them, and hopefully the judges will like them. It just keeps you going. Each generation is, you know, a new adventure.
The 141st Westminster Kennel Club Dog Show is over. It's a tradition to our show, and of course, it brings to us each year...
Sarah Montague, co-host of the podcast Dog Story, and happily the resident takeaway dog correspondent.
Great to have you here. You're up all night, of course.
Up all night.
Yeah. 2,700 dogs strutted their stuff, showing off their agility, obedience, knocking out the competition. And, of course, the show culminated with the climatic judges' pick for Best in Show.
The Best in Show at the 141st Annual Westminster Kennel Club Dog Show, the German Shepherd Dog.
Rumor wins Best in Show.
Rumor has it.
Well, it was certainly a tough choice. I mean, when you get dogs like this, you truthfully can point in one of seven directions and still be right. But I thought the Shepherd bitch was just beautiful. You know, and the Shepherd Standard talks about quality and nobility, and that kept ringing in my head, and I looked at her and I thought, there it is.
That was our Best in Show judge, Thomas H. Bradley III, talking about his pick of Rumor, the German Shepherd dog, a really lovely way of describing her particular qualities, of course.
How true is Private Rintintin? They are the Army's pride and joy.
America has had a romance with the German Shepherd dog since Rintintin came back from World War One. Rumor was heavily picked to win last year and didn't, so I think there was an enormous kind of wave of excitement for her this year when she did in fact make it.
Now, I associate, you know, the Westminster Dog Show with all the frilly kinds of unusual breeds, but German Shepherd, all right.
You couldn't have given me a better lead-in, because one of my favorite overheard remarks of the evening was I was standing waiting to get onto the floor, and I heard one security guard say to another, "Now there's an everyday dog." It's one of the nice things about them. They are, of course, they're herding dogs. They are traditionally designed to help you keep your flocks in order. But they're tremendous family dogs. And you could, the thing about her that you could really see is her incredible sweetness of expression on this extremely powerful all-purpose body.
Who was the runner-up? Oh, who was the competition?
The runner-up was the reserve champion this year was a Irish setter, beautiful Irish setter. And then, of course, there are five other dogs. By the time you get to this stage in the competition, you have seven group winners, each of whom is an excellent example of its particular type. I was particularly excited by two kind of demographic moments here. The winner of the hound group was the Norwegian Elkhound, whose breeder and handler is 81 years old.
She doesn't miss a trick, and sometimes she'll take you out in the process. You can be coming along, and all of a sudden she'll see a bench, sail up on top of it and look out over and say, "I spot a seal out there."
You couldn't see a spryer, happier woman than she was. And the handler for the miniature poodle, also bred and owned by him, was 28. So there's this great spectrum at the garden.
I would be surprised that the Irish setter would have done so well as runner-up, you say?
Yes, what's called the reserve champion now.
Because the breed has had so many problems, and it's so difficult to actually get an Irish setter that isn't, you know, a bit of a basket case.
The nice thing about the garden, about the whole focus of this show, is that responsible breeders are enormously concerned about this, and almost all breed clubs have research programs for any particular fragilities in their breeds. And it does mean, as they tell us constantly at the garden, that you're looking at the best examples of these dogs by people who are responsible and care about them deeply. One of the other things that really strikes me about this, of course, this is a good example, is we're having a difficult time with diversity at the moment.
You know, we seem as people to
have a difficult time embracing our differences, and yet the dog show is the most perfect example of this. They come spotted and hairless and hairy and small and large, and we love this. We love the fact that they are all so different. Why can't we do this for ourselves?
Dogs are different. Are the breeders all driving around in, you know, Escalades and BMWs?
Absolutely not. In fact, one of the nice things about this particular show this year is that four of the seven finalists were what is known as breeder owner handlers. They bred their own dogs. They take their own dogs around. They are workaday people. Yes, it certainly requires some money to do this, but it's not a question of, you know, the Bentleys versus the tractors by any means.
Everyday Dogs, Everyday Dog Breeders, and a great show this year for the 141st. Sarah, it's always great to talk to you.
It's always a pleasure to be here.
Lessons from Westminster from Sarah Montague, takeaway resident dog show correspondent. On Monday, in honor of President's Day, we're dedicating a whole hour to presidential power. So how has your view of presidential power changed? Where have presidents become more or less powerful?
This is Amy Rosenstein from White Plains, and I've always been thankful for the system of checks and balances. Having the courts intervene in the ban was the perfect example. I'm not sure, however, that the current president was aware that he needed to answer to anyone.
This is Kate in North Palm Beach, Florida. Executive orders are just too much. No one person should have that much power, no matter who that person is.
Do you like a president, or would you rather have a king? Let us know how your notion of presidential power has evolved. 877-8-MY-TAKE. Join the conversation on the Facebook page of The Takeaway. Thanks, as always, for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.